Welcome to the Minimum Viable Podcast, a project of the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum. Our mission is to inspire, connect, and empower people in order to promote a culture of innovation in the U.S. national security community. You can learn more about DEF and get involved at DEF.org. That's DEF.org. We look forward to your ideas and are excited to connect you with other doers working on hard problems.
So we're excited today to have Zachary here to talk with us about many articles he has written. And for those of you who do not know him, he is actually, he is a strategic futurist who has had a lot of presence in the national security space as an intelligence officer. And he's trying to really figure out what national security looks like for the 21st century. He's also a security fellow at the Truman National Security Project and a proclaimed U.S. Army Futures Command mad scientist, and serves on the board of the Military Writers Guild. And in addition to that, he is an Army veteran. So Zachary, thank you for joining us today. So what we're going to do today is we're going to be talking about the two articles that Zachary wrote, in addition to probably some others that will probably creep in throughout the discussion, and the premise that we need to reframe the national security space. So Zachary, I want to hand it over to you. And can you kind of tell me a little bit about what drove you to write these two articles? One is the U.S. intelligence community is caught in a collector's trap, and the other one is the U.S. intelligence community is being disrupted.
Sure. I'm happy to. Thank you, Jen. And I should say, first of all, you know, thank you to DEF for inviting me. Very happy to be here, proud member of the community. And, you know, it's great to see so many people tuned in, taking time out of their day to listen to us chat about this stuff. So these two particular articles, it really, you know, I've been writing articles now publicly for about, probably about a year and a half now, really, since I left government. I left government at the end of 2018. My last assignment I was a GS-13 in DOD. I went to the National Intelligence University, and really while I was there, I started working on a thesis project about sort of, you know, how the intelligence community evolved, came about in the first place, how we got our national security structure that we have today. And it was really my thesis advisor, who is a guy named Josh Kerbel, who's written also prolifically in, you know, places like National Review and Defense One and stuff about IC reform. He was the guy who kind of encouraged me to go out and speak out more publicly, because he made me understand that, you know, there's only so much you can do from inside the system, because we all have restrictions, we all have bosses we report to, we all have, you know, we're part of an organization and we have to protect the organization's interests. Really from the outside, we're allowed to be a little more circumspect, a little more, maybe perhaps a little more critical than we would be if we were speaking on behalf of an agency or of an organization. And, you know, that's not, I don't mean to be critical of the IC. I mean, the IC is wonderful. It's helped protect our country for 75 years almost now. There's been plenty of intelligence failures that have been well publicized, but there's obviously, you know, many of unknown intelligence successes as well. So I wrote these two articles in particular, though, because they're a distillation of my thesis and a continuation of that research. And I feel like it's important that we question sort of every assumption we've had from the last century and really from the 19th century as we move into this sort of new uncharted era of, you know, the information age and the 21st century and what it's bringing for us. So the perspective I brought to that is, you know, I joined the Army as a private first class in 2001. And, you know, so I kind of had I have the privilege, I think, of having been, you know, at that sort of low level of doing the sort of intel nug work, you know, of a PFC or a specialist, and then being an NCO over the years. And then later in my career coming up and being a civil servant and a contractor and a consultant working, you know, at the Pentagon and elsewhere. So I've kind of seen, you know, what the structure looks like from a lot of different angles. And, you know, I think I speak for, you know, I don't want to be I don't want to have hubris, but the feedback I've gotten, I feel like I speak for a generation of people my age and younger who've kind of come up through the post 9/11 intelligence community structure that was so fixated on counterterrorism and counterinsurgency in Iraq and Afghanistan. And now we kind of realize that, it perhaps may not be the best suited for the challenges we're now facing in great power competition.
That is really sort of, those are the themes that you really have in both of your articles. And in particular, the article that you have on the US intelligence community needs to be disrupted. You say that one of the reasons that the IC needs to be disrupted is because big institutions are often blinded by their success. But with the current environment, it seems often that the IC may be hunkered down due to the relationship with senior leadership and government rather than blinded by their success. So do you see that differently, and how, or what would you do?
So that's a great question. I mean, you know, I don't like to get caught in the sort of the scrum of the day to day. I mean, you know, the IC serves, you know, senior executives, and particularly the, you know, the first customer in the White House. And presidents have always had a, you know, an argumentative, combative sort of relationship with the intelligence community, at least since Pearl Harbor. Their favored scapegoat is what I call the IC. Now, I mean, that's a lot of that is politics. But I think that when I say success, you know, I mean that. So the original title of this article, let me digress for a moment. The original title of the article was "The Intelligence Community Needs a New Business Model." And I started using, I've read a lot of books, you know, you can see back there about business model disruption and how to make value propositions. And sort of the success I mentioned is, you know, the IC was the only game in town for, I mean, at least 50 years, for a half century or more. You know, policymakers on both sides of the aisle, you know, even through crises, like, I mean, obviously the Cuban Missile Crisis is a great example, you know. They brought, you know, photographic evidence of Soviet missiles being in place in Cuba. That was a slam dunk win, even though strategically we sort of missed the emplacement of missiles in the first place. And Sherman Kent, who was the father of the IC, was sort of embarrassed about that for the rest of his life. But you go through, you know, all the history of the intelligence community, the year of intelligence in 1974, you know, all the like scandals that came to the forefront, even with all that baggage, policymakers had to rely upon the IC because it was really the only institution that could look behind the Iron Curtain and could give at least even semi-accurate estimates of Soviet military capabilities. And, you know, what are those pesky Russians going to do? Are they going to invade through Europe? Or, you know, where are they? What are they doing? There was no real competition for that. So the success was sort of, hey, we made it. You know, even if they don't follow our recommendations or listen to us particularly, they're at least going to get our insights on national intelligence estimates. These days, that's different because there are so many other outlets where policymakers can get their own sort of curated, personalized news and view of the world that agrees with their personal, you know, political opinions or their biases or preferences. And that was not the case for a long, long time. I mean, that's a fundamental difference of sort of the internet revolution and the proliferation of all these different media outlets out there.
Yeah, so since I'm a member of the intelligence community and have been for, you know, 25 years, I think that there is some of that still exists where people do value what we produce as an organization, as a community, as entities, even as own individual organizations. But how can the intelligence community continue to be at the forward leading edge of an innovation like we were over the past 70 years and still not be blinded by those stovetypes or those archetypes that we have kind of fallen into over the last, you know, period of history?
Well, I mean, I think that is that's the golden question. It's kind of like, I mean, that's the reason I think DEF exists in the first place, because the same, you know, a lot of people don't understand that, you know, they talk about the IC and the Defense Department. I mean, most of the IC is the Defense Department. So like all the big, most of the big agencies aside from CIA are Defense Department agencies. So defense innovation and reform is essentially intelligence community reform. But I think to fix it, to stay on that leading edge, I mean, I think it requires a culture change. I think we've become far too routinized in the sort of business practices that we have. It's all about, you know, we measure analysts by their output, by how many products they send out per week or per quarter, per month. It's all about getting an article into PDB is kind of the, you know, the greatest thing you can do as a CIA or DIA analyst. And even for, you know, current intelligence and people that work in situation rooms and talks around the world, it's all about getting out that daily or morning product to satisfy the boss and let them know what's going on. So those are all sort of industrialized, mechanistic corporate processes. I think if we're going to challenge those and figure out what is it actually that we're doing here, what is the value we're providing, we need to really inject more of a startup mentality. I mean, it's all about creativity. It's all about bucking the status quo, finding out what we can do to actually drive positive change in both policy and the way we structure organizations and meet the challenges that we have. And don't get me wrong, I mean, there's certainly offices out there that are doing a lot of great innovation work. I mean, there's CIA Spark program, there's ODI's Office of Lateral Innovation. There's obviously outfits like IARPA and NQTL Fund Startup on behalf of the IC. But I mean, the problem with these is that they're always, at least from people I've spoken with and from what I've heard, they're seen as sort of outliers or add-ons or extras, nice to have. They're not really seen as the real work of the IC. I mean, the real work is kind of all done back behind the SCIF door. It's kind of the day-to-day, you know, working of assessing products and putting finished intelligence out the door. You know, then that's how you get sort of the criticism of innovation theater. I think if we're going to actually take advantage of all those innovations and all the things that are being brought online, it's going to require not only that cultural change, but also structural change within the system itself.
Yeah, so that really does get to the accessibility of information, I think, is what you're talking about. And not just information, but the products and services that the intelligence community is putting out. You've sort of alluded to this now twice, which is relating to the business model needs to change and whether that business model is focused on, no kidding, like what a real business model would be in the private sector or a business model that might focus on culture and some other things. So what do you see or what do you recommend as a possible business model that would fit today's challenges for the entire national security space and not necessarily just the intelligence community?
So, I mean, that's why I started thinking about this issue in particular, because, I started out thinking about intelligence community reform. And I thought, you know, look, we need to have a more, and it sounds like a buzzword, but it's true. We need more agile, more flexible intelligence organizations. We need to be able to rapidly sort of flex resources whenever crises arise, but then also just as rapidly bring them back in whenever the crisis subsides, instead of, you know, having programs that last, you know, 10 or 15 years and they're impossible to shut down, even though nobody's used it for a decade. I realized that you couldn't just reform the IC, because the IC exists as part of this larger superstructure. And it all sort of came about with, you know, the National Security Act of 1947. And the problem with the National Security Act of 1947 is there's a great book about it called Flawed by Design by Amy Zagart. And she goes through the whole history of sort of how, you know, the political horse trading and deals that were put together. I mean, it was argument between the Navy and the Army about creating the DoD in the first place. What were the powers of the Secretary of Defense going to be? You know, how would they protect the interests of the services? Should we have a Joint Chiefs of Staff at all? We had sort of a World War II coordinating, you know, proto Joint Chiefs of Staff. And they sort of voted by majority to make decisions, but they didn't want that after the end of the war. And then, you know, the CIA was kind of created as an afterthought. It was just like a sentence included in the NSA of 1947, and Truman didn't even want to use it at first. Same thing with the National Security Council. It was kind of intended to be a coordinating body to sort of sort papers and send them around to the president, but it turned into this sort of board of directors in this in the business metaphor model that I use. So, you know, I think we really need we need congressional bipartisan think tank, and this has happened before. There's been plenty of think tanks on this, but we need action about a deliberately designed national security ecosystem that is more suited to 21st century challenges. And it has to recognize the fact that, you know, threats are much faster today than they were in the past. The world is much more connected. We can't really separate domains as we could in the past. You know, even in the military sphere, you know, maritime domains blending over with land and air and space, and all the sort of old distinctions that we inherited from the past are dissipating. There's much less of a distinction now between foreign and domestic. I mean, we're in constant contact with our enemies. Whether it's Russian election interference or Chinese or whoever your preferred enemy is, I mean, they're here on the ground and they're in the internet and they're talking to our people every day. That's a radically different threat environment than what the world looked like after World War II, when the United States was the sort of unquestioned, not a hegemon, but, you know, the strongest power in the world when Europe was decimated. So, you know, we don't have all the advantages we had in the past, and we need a national security system that reflects that. Specifically, I think we need to look at three areas to answer your actual question. I'm sorry for the soapboxing. I think we need to look at security classification reform. I mean, that affects everything from who we hire, you know, the kind of talent that we need. First and second generation Americans, it's hard for them to get into, you know, the national security system. And we obviously, everybody knows we overclassify too much stuff, but no one is really doing anything to change it because, I mean, that's all controlled in the executive branch. You know, 12333 controls how we classify everything. And that affects security clearance process. It affects human capital. It affects what kind of digital infrastructure we can have. That's the second big area we need to look at, by the way, digital infrastructure, because we do need to be able to share things. People need to be able to collaborate, not only between agencies, but even within agencies. It's hard for different divisions and branches of agencies to talk to each other and coordinate on products. You know, DOD and DIC and wider in general can't use products like companies use routinely in the private sector, you know, collaboration tools and other things. We just don't have that because of security concerns. And then the last big area to focus on would be the talent management. And all these are interwoven. I mean, it's a complex problem, wicked problem. You can't really fix one without fixing the other, which is why I advocate for a holistic reform. And even though I would, you know, I always say that all the sort of innovations we do and, you know, apps we develop and, you know, new systems we bring online, all that's necessary. We need all that because that's the price of staying relevant. But that's not ever going to solve systemic problems unless we reform the structure and we enable our people to be more creative and more collaborative to be able to solve the problems we have.
Yeah,
I wasn't too long, sorry.
This is great because I'll also mention first that the Air Force was also created in that National Security Act that you mentioned, where the NSC and the CIA were born out of. I have to stick that in there. But I would also say that it kind of your central theme once again comes back to accessibility, whether it's having the right people, the right information, the right product, the right service, or whatever it may be. And that really does speak to my heart, especially based on my TEDx talk that I did related to human machine teaming. And one of the paragraphs in the articles that you wrote that really struck me, there's a quote that I'll pull out of it that I'll say. It's the quote, "The intelligence community has overinvested in technical collection platforms at the expense of the people who give the information those systems collect context. Today's consumers of intelligence are drowning in data, but thirsting for insight." And what you just talked about really relates a lot to that. But also based on that quote and the things you mentioned in both of your articles, how do you think that the national security community can take those recommendations that you had, whether it's national security reform, digital transformation, talent management, to better analyze that data and to make better decisions?
So, you know, you hear people a lot talk about data-driven decisions. I don't think we should let data drive our decisions. I think data should inform our decisions. Because at the end of the day, it's human beings that, like I say in the article, give that data context. And you can't, you know, it's sort of a, there's two ways to look at the world. One of them is, you know, everything can be quantified. You know, if we have the right data, we'll be able to make the best decision. But my perspective, and this is, you know, I wouldn't call myself an expert by any means, but I talk to a lot of experts. I think the world is much messier than that. It's a complex adaptive system. You know, there's going to be things we cannot predict. There'll be minuscule errors in any data collection we have that is going to have outsized effects elsewhere. If you look at events like, you know, the Arab Spring, for example, is one I always use. I mean, it's, you know, those conditions were set in place for decades, but nothing happened until there was a particular spark when that system reached criticality and it, you know, cascaded into the sort of wave of disruptive protests and eventually riots and the regime change. It sparked the Libyan war and the Syrian civil war that we're still dealing with today. I mean, that was a complex cascading effect. Regimes that had been, you know, oppressing their people for decades in North Africa and the Middle East. There'd been famines before, there'd been people hungry, but all those elements sort of combined. And as I mentioned, reached a state of criticality where one guy, you know, just because a corrupt police officer confiscated his food for the day that he was going to sell, he lit himself on fire in protest, and that kind of ignited this wave of human change across the region. And I don't think we can predict that. There's no amount of data collection, even if we monitored every social media system on Earth, there's going to be things we can't predict. So to give that context, I think you need analysts, human analysts, that are aided and enabled by AI assistance. I mean, I've always said I would much rather see I want to have like a Siri with me in the skiff that is like my AI assistant as a human analyst. And I want it to be able to give me not only to check me for biases that I have as a human being, you know, hey, are you sure you're not weighting this too much? Or, you know, just little prompts like that to have me check my thinking. I also want to be able to use it as a tool to just call up data or, you know, present data graphically for let me make sense of it. You know, hey, let's just call it Siri. Hey, how much oil did Libya import from Russia in the last 5 years? And it would bring it up in a graph and show me. I mean, that's what machines are really good at, collating, aggregating data, putting it in ways we can visualize it much better, and then keeping track of all that data. But only human beings can actually make those connections based on context and judgment and lived experience to sort of know where those little nuggets of insight are. And I think that's the ultimate role of the intelligence community, is it's not to just give data to, you know, a policymaker or a commander, it's to give them insights that they can, you know, help achieve their mission or accomplish their, you know, drive forward, whatever it is they're trying to do, or to mitigate risk. So, I mean, I know that's not a perfect answer, but I don't have a perfect answer. I think it's got to be a combination of, you know, intelligent assistance, data aggregation and display, and then obviously human judgment and creativity.
I, you know, from my own perspective, I think that the way that analysis is going and we need to continue to think about is, you know, we don't want people to answer the what happened anymore. We want them to be able to answer the why and the what's next, and let the machines do the what happened, make them collate all the data and bring it together, and then allow us to use our ability to put pieces together to detect what, you know, is going to happen in the future, or try to determine what will happen in the future.
And even, you know, I would even like to see, and I'm sure I'm confident this will happen, is you know, you're going to have AIs that will be able to do a lot of the sort of day-to-day. I mean, we already have storytelling AIs that can write sentences and paragraphs that are pretty comparable to what a human can do. I think they're going to be doing the sort of day-to-day situation reports, and, you know, this happened today in whatever, pick a country where there's a conflict going on, and that'll give sort of the human analyst, it'll free up their time to do sort of the deeper work of cognition and thinking about alternative futures and what this might mean. And just to double tap on your point, I think it's not only, you know, there's the five golden questions, the what happened and why did it happen, and, you know, what, but really, what does it mean, or what are the implications? That's what the human intelligence analyst is there for, and I think that's what the IC is there for. So, you know, it's going back to the business model question. I think it's, in the past, the business model was, what's going on in the world? You know, we got to figure that out. We don't know what the Soviets are up to. So we built all these, you know, very expensive systems and satellites and listening posts and all this stuff around the world to get that information. And that, for a long time, that was good enough. Give us the information. How many missiles do the Soviets have? Is there a gap? You know, are we good enough? But now, you know, information is kind of everywhere. We're drowning in it, as I said. So really, the value proposition now for analysts is helping decision makers to actually sort that information, figure out what's important, what they can ignore, where there might be opportunities to do something that they didn't think about earlier, because, you know, policymakers don't have time to do that. I mean, they're moving from meeting to meeting every day, and their days are managed in 5-minute increments or less. So really, you know, the human intelligence analyst is more like almost like just a digital assistant for a human policymaker by helping them to sort the information that's out there in a messy world.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. One of the things that several people have talked about recently, or in the recent past, and especially Lieutenant General Jameson, who recently retired, is that traditionally the intelligence community relied on being the ones that had only the access to the information. So think of it as a right side up triangle. And the tip of the triangle was what was available publicly, and everything else that was sort of at that probably 7/8 of the bottom of the triangle is what was available in the classified arena. But now you flip that on its head, and the point of the triangle is at the bottom, and it's only 1/7 or 1/8 of the triangle, which is now classified, which is that pristine data, and everything else is easily accessible in the real world. And right. So the things that I wanted to ask you about is that we've been talking about leveraging technologies and using these new and adaptive concepts in order to get really to the future of where we should be working. But many people are averse to taking risks and doing the unconventional and trying to fix their business processes or changing their culture. So what recommendations do you have to help us drive towards that?
Oh, that's a tough one. I mean, it's really hard to sort of get. So I think there's, you know, you use the model of early adoption for new technology. And everybody, I'm sure everybody who's a deaf member is familiar with it. You've got, you know, obviously your early adopters and your middle bulk and then your late adopters. I think most, and I'm just going to make this up because, you know, why not? It's 5:30. I think many, if not most, government employees are towards the middle to late end of that, because it doesn't matter what your politics are, but if you're working in a bureaucracy, you're inherently a little more conservative than people who might be, you know, entrepreneurs out in the world or startups or, you know, taking risks. Government is not built to do risk. I mean, we want our government to be stable, predictable, to be able to manage, you know, things on a day-to-day basis and be competent. So that mindset is not really, it's not really conducive to the work of government as we've imagined it for the last, I don't know, at least a couple hundred years. So I think to change that, you know, we need to, it's not just going to be, we can't just send government employees to an hour-long seminar about innovation and say, okay, you guys are good, go out and innovate the system. I think it has to be, you know, any change that's going to occur is going to be the way it always occurs in this country, which is a collaboration between the private sector, the government, and you know, F, driving change and being sort of the thought leaders that sort of push for reforms to happen with, you know, sponsors in Congress, with other, you know, think tanks and entities that are out there. I mean, the beauty of the United States is we don't have, you know, unlike China, we don't have a top-down system where, you know, the leader makes a choice and it's sort of just flooded down to all the different channels and carried out. I mean, we have competing centers of power in this country that can, you know, that creative abrasion that occurs from all these different points of view kind of coming together. That's the beauty of a republic and a democracy, where we can take the best ideas from whatever your politics are, whatever party you're a part of, whatever axe to grind you have. If you have a good idea, it'll shake out in the public domain, and we can incorporate that into our legislation. So I was just saying that, you know, we have the beauty of this country is we have a lot of different points of view, and we can take advantage of those points of view to take the best ideas, craft them in the legislation, and then enact those reforms. And not just within our country, we also have a great suite of allies and partners that are also experimenting and taking risks. And we can take all those ideas and incorporate them into the reforms we need. So, you know, long story short, we need to take advantage of every opportunity we have and then put those ideas in the legislative packages and get reforms made to help us to win the competition we're in.
Great. Are there any other last comments you'd like to have before we open it for questions?
No, I think we basically covered it, and I hope that I hope we get some good questions in case the internet goes out again. So I apologize for cutting out there for a moment.
It's all good. Okay, so if you guys have a question to ask, please raise your hand, and you can do that, like I said, if you weren't here from the beginning, at the bottom of your window for participants, and your hand will get raised by on the screen for me, and I can call on you, and then you can unmute yourself and ask your question. Or if you would like me to ask your question on your behalf, privately or openly, you can text it to me, and I'm more than willing to do that. So here is the first question. Are you ready, Zachary? Here we go.
I'm ready.
Do you think our SOF operators are able to maintain a stealth cover in today's digital world? And is that a factor that causes the U.S. to change its mindset?
No, I do not think. So don't get me wrong. I mean, I think especially our tier one SOF units have amazing capabilities. Don't get me wrong. Absolutely. But if you look at, there's a great example, you know, the Bin Laden raid, 2011? That was live tweeted, you know, from a guy in Pakistan who heard the stealth helicopters coming in, and it was captured as it was happening. And, you know, I'm not the only one to say this. I mean, there's been, you know, SOCOM commanders that have come out and said, look, we're operating in a world now where we are no longer able to, you know, act clandestinely as we could in the past. And CIA has come to recognize this too. There's a brilliant article came out last year sometime, I forget the name, but it was basically saying that, you know, with digital fingerprints and all the traces we leave online, it's much harder today for anybody to keep a sort of clandestine second, you know, persona when they try to travel to another country to adopt a, you know, to adopt a pseudonym. So the whole sort of practice of spycraft and covert operations is being challenged in this sort of new world we live in, where everyone is a camera, everyone is a sensor. We used to say every soldier is a sensor, but now every human being on the planet is a sensor. And in the near future, every object will be a sensor as more things get plugged into the Internet of Stuff. So I don't think that is a sustainable model for the future, unfortunately. I think we're going to have to figure out a way either to be more overt in our actions, which means a much more dangerous world, or, you know, what do I know? There might be technologies that are coming online that will help us to mitigate some of those problems. But it's definitely a challenge for now, and I think for the foreseeable future.
All right. Thank you. Anybody else have a question? I know you guys have questions. Don't be shy. If not, you get to listen to me ask questions, and Zachary can just pontificate for hours, too. So please.
Yeah, I'm known to do so, and I have a drink, so I'm happy to start.
Okay, so maybe I'll ask another one. So one of the big things you talk about is that analysis that we've been sort of, you know, talking about back and forth, and talking about anticipation and foresight. How do you think you cultivate a culture of anticipation and foresight?
This is almost my favorite subject. Glad you asked. And in fact, I'm trying to write something about this right now. I think that, so as I mentioned, I don't think the world is as predictable as it used to be because it's more complex than it was in the past. And two, I think that because of that, because we're not going to be able to predict when a regime change happens or when an invasion is about to start, we need to move from a model of forecasting to foresight. And the difference is, you know, forecast would be, hey, you know, the Russians are going to invade Ukraine in, you know, 2 to 4 weeks. And that's obviously, that's prediction. There's indicators you can look for that may, you know, say, sway that judgment one way or the other. Foresight would be, what would we do if the Russians invaded Ukraine? What if it looked like this? What if it looked like that? What if it was a, you know, surreptitious incursion with little green men? What if it was a full-blown, you know, armored column across the border? Foresight is more anticipatory in that it, you know, it requires, and to answer your question, it requires creativity. Imagination, creativity, and that comes from a variety of places. It comes from psychological safety, first of all. We need to have not only, you know, a diverse workforce that is inclusive, where people can, you know, voice their opinions, disagree with others, sort of have an off-the-wall viewpoint, and all that kind of gets mushed together into this creative process where you come up with, you know, what would we do if X? What would we do if Y? And then you sort of frame those out from a wide variety of viewpoints. And then the other thing I would say is for that, the fuel for creativity is a wide variety of inputs. So, you know, I always tell when young analysts ask me how to be a better analyst, I'm like, you need to read everything. You need to, and that, when I say read, I don't mean, it doesn't have to be a book. It could be a podcast that you listen to. It could be a blog that you read on technological developments. It could be talking to other people in your workplace or the customers that you're supporting. It's basically however you take information in, that's more grist for your, you know, for your meal that's inside your head. And unconsciously or subconsciously or consciously, that's going to be riding around inside your brain. And you're eventually going to use that for creative energy when you come up with brainstorming ideas. So, I mean, I think that's the number one thing is creativity.
It's interesting because McKinsey's done numerous studies on workforce of the future and talking about that the majority of us are going to be working alongside machines very soon in the near future, at least by 2030. And the big thing that is going to differentiate those from those that don't succeed and those that do succeed is the creativity and creative thinking that goes along with it in order to be able to adapt to the new environment.
Yeah, absolutely. I just to add on to that, because you made me think of it, That's the real superpower that humans have, is we're creative engines. Our brains are wired to imagine things. We're never going to beat an AI at information recall. You know, a computer will be able to recall a fact or a figure or a distance or, you know, a range of a weapon system, whatever it is, much faster, much more accurately than we ever will be able to. So we should give them that. We should just get out of that business altogether. We should have analysts that are doing that creative, you know, linking together of all the different silos of information out there and creating sort of, so I was going to say, Greg Treverton, former NIC chairperson, he said recently that intelligence was ultimately about storytelling. And we need more storytellers, I think, in the IC. That's the real value proposition, is being able to not only, you know, write coherently, that's always been important, but being able to speak to people and explain to them complex issues in a way that is not, you know, full of babble or bureaucratic cant or language that makes us sound like we're in the ivory tower. We need to be able to level with policymakers from the president down and give them sort of the so what of a complex situation in 5 minutes or less. And that's a hard skill to acquire. And like I said, it requires, you know, diverse viewpoints, creativity and imagination, and above all, psychological safety.
Right. All right, Trish, your turn to ask a question.
Zach, really glad to see you tonight. Zach and I go back many, many years, both worked at JIDO back in our heyday, and I have seen Zach live and in person giving Intel briefs and just really mastering the craft. So really glad to see you here tonight, Zach. I guess I would just ask you a typical question, maybe not so typical, but when did you start to feel that your perception or opinion of what right looked like in the intelligence community started to branch off? And what would you tell your Intel analyst self now that you know when you started engaging in intelligence analysis that long ago?
So I'll answer the second one first, because I know that absolutely. The one thing I would tell myself 5 years, even 10 or 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, would be the value of networking, which I never understood. I was all, you know, like a lot of analysts, I imagine, I was very introverted, still am. I like to be working on my issue, you know, head down, reading about something, writing a paper, whatever it was. And I had sort of this misconception that in government, if you did your work and you did good products and you delivered a lot of stuff on time, eventually, you know, you're going to get promoted up to the top and you're going to be recognized for your good stuff. And that may be true for some people, for many people, but it wasn't true for me. And I learned that, you know, when I left government, establishing a network and having, you know, people, because it doesn't matter, what I've learned is, it doesn't matter how smart you are, doesn't matter what you know or how great your insights are, if you can't deliver it into the hands of the right people, it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter what I write, if nobody reads it, it doesn't do anything. It's just, you know, an exercise in self-gratification. So I wish I would have known long ago to sort of cultivate that network. And it's not, you know, I think a lot of analysts sort of think of networking as kind of this skeezy thing that, you know, business people do. And that's certainly what I thought. And I was wrong, 100% wrong. I mean, it's not about, you know, getting ahead or getting a new job, even though that could be a side benefit. It's about being able to unite together a group of like-minded people who are, you know, there's a concept called, there's not just, you know, event luck, there's people luck. So there's people that come into your life that could change the trajectory of what you're doing just by virtue of who they know and connecting their network to your network. So in terms of the intelligence community, I think the one thing we could do to really empower US intelligence is plug the entire network in to where everyone could speak to everyone else. We kind of do it on an ad hoc basis now with like conferences and seminars. And a lot of that is sort of bloviating, and you go and listen to the same people talk, you know, for an hour at a time. But really, being able to have that collaboration across agencies, within agencies, and having people know who the right persons are working on a topic. And it doesn't have to be, it doesn't even need to be the topics you would think they are. You could have an insight come from some topic that is three or four away from whatever category you're working on. And really, if we were going to create a new national security structure that is more fit for today, it would be kind of this amorphous, you know, blob. It's always, blob is a bad word for national security. People don't like that, but more like a living organism that could transfer information from cell to cell without all the like bureaucratic roadblocks and hurdles that you have to jump over there to make that happen. And then I'm sorry, I forgot the other question because I bloviated.
When did you realize that you were kind of diverging on what right looked like? Or maybe kind of, you know, the classic Intel, doing Intel the classic way, to you going, Wait, hang on. That doesn't make sense.
I think it was probably when I was at NIU. I mean, I think that before that, I was sort of stuck in the, you know, I'm only going to focus on my area. Like if I, you know, when I was at JIDO, I did current intelligence. So I was, you know, I was, I was concerned about getting a brief together for the 3-star every day, you know, editing, doing all the things. And if it wasn't in that area, if it was like an IED network that someone was targeting, I didn't care about that. It was, you know, not my job, not my circus. What I learned when I was at NIU is that, you know, the Intel community in the national security world is much, much bigger than I ever thought it was. And it encompasses everything from, you know, obviously, you know, public health is a huge concern today with COVID and what we're going through, you know, public diplomacy, all these sort of issues that I never thought about when I was a, you know, 25 or 30 year old analyst. And then perhaps that's just my own shortcoming. But, you know, I learned that, you know, there's much more going on out there than I could ever know about. And even today, you know, I'm not, you know, I don't put myself up as like knowing everything about how we should change or what kind of model we do. But I do know that there's problems with the current model. And what I learned is, you know, we have a lot of really smart, dedicated, patriotic people that are doing excellent work. But that may not be enough for the kind of challenges that we face today. So I think that, you know, we have to connect that network, like I said in the first answer. And I know that's not a satisfactory answer, but that's what I got.
All right, we have about 6 more questions and 15-ish minutes. So let's kind of do like a rapid fire round and go from there, if that's good for you. The first one is there enough investment in AI, artificial intelligence right now in the DoD and the IC being spent in best ways to accelerate transformation and deliver mission results?
I'm not really, I can't really answer that question authoritatively. I mean, my opinion would be, we don't really know what we want to use AI for. And we have, you know, there's the Joint Artificial Intelligence Center, and they're doing a lot of good work making investments in AI for the department. You know, the ODNI has its augmenting intelligence machines framework where we're trying to improve AI for analysis and the way the IC does business. But I don't think that, I think when AI really comes online, and I'm sure that it will imminently in the next, at least, you know, the next decade, 15 years, maybe, it's going to have aspects and applications that we don't even think of now, because I don't think we know, how it's going to impact our systems yet. So we're kind of like at the, and I'm sorry, this isn't rapid fire. I apologize, but that's just how I am. Let's go to the next one. I'm sorry.
All right. No, it's all good. Next one's from David. He said, fascinating discussion. While technology is getting more and more capable, I also believe 100% that human analysts are the only real way of understanding, are the only real way of understanding context and nuance of the data and interpreting and making use of the secrets hiding within the data. But I also believe human analysts can really only do the magic trick for the areas, domains, cultures they actually know very well. So if all of the above is true, and any ideas or thoughts on new approaches to recruiting and improving human analysts?
Yeah, we need a more diverse workforce. We need not just to hire, you know, another white guy like me who comes from rural Kentucky. We have plenty of those guys. There's like, we need more first and second generation Americans who speak languages, who have different cultural outlooks, people who are, you know, love this country and patriotic and want to work in national security, but find it much too difficult to get into the system today because of security classification requirements, investigation requirements, and just other aspects that they would never even think to apply, and they're not recruited because agencies don't particularly look for them because they may not target the schools they go to or whatever it is. One of the things I really care about is growing the volume of diversity inclusion in the national security workforce. And I talk to students all the time who don't know how to get into government in the first place. They don't know how to get into the IC specifically. And they think that it would never be for them because, one, they didn't go to an Ivy League school perhaps, or two, they think it's, you know, they'll never get a security clearance. So they don't even apply. And I think that's one of the biggest flaws we have. I wrote an article about that actually recently, is that, you know, America has the most diverse population of any of our competitors, certainly more so than Russia or China, but we're not taking full advantage of that diverse set of perspectives that we have to make better decisions.
Yeah, I would agree. John has a question. Where is the best place to start reengineering or disrupting, or maybe better asked about Zach and Jen's thoughts on priority of effort on what needs to change sooner versus later? Options, leadership, talent hiring, organizational structure, what?
Do you want to take this one first since I asked?
I actually think talent needs to be a main focus. Diversifying the talent and having people who both understand technology, but also understand the environment that we live in and the international relations we have.
Yeah, 100% agree. I think that, you know, we have plenty of great leaders. There's plenty of, you know, smart people at the top of these agencies that are very well qualified and have been in the IC for a long time. The org structure, I mean, that's going to require probably congressional action to fix that, which doesn't seem like it'll happen anytime soon. I mean, the one thing we can do is try to improve our hiring practices by removing some of those hurdles to get that diversity of thought that I mentioned.
All right, next one. Do you see a future where, given the pace of digital innovation, specialized private sector startups can be bought out by the intelligence community to monitor boutique problem sets?
That's an interesting question. I've never thought about it. I don't think, I don't know if that authorities exist in law now or not. I mean, I'm not a congressional person, but it's certainly an interesting idea. So the way I understand the question is, if there was a startup who had a niche capability, could the ISC just buy it outright? I think that, you know, that's kind of what InQtel does. They don't buy them, but they fund programs like that with startup companies. And if they sort of incorporate that technology into the IC that way. I don't know if there exists a mechanism to buy a company outright, Jen, do you?
So I think they're really talking about buying out, such as bringing them in to do just a new unique problem set. And I will say, based on the company that I'm currently in, that this is something that the intelligence community, non-DoD intelligence community, is really focusing on, is really looking at what the companies are that have niche capabilities to solve some of the hardest problems that they have right now that they're facing. So I think it's actually happening right now.
Cool.
Okay, the next one is, you mentioned reading everything to make better analysts. Do you have any specific recommendations for books, podcasts, or publications?
There's too many books to list. One podcast that I really enjoy is called The Knowledge Project with Shane Parrish. It's from Farnham Street. And it's the new episode every week, and he brings on thought leaders in the private sector, agile sort of startup people, investors, entrepreneurs, and then also, you know, things like cognitive psychologists. And they really, every episode is kind of a deep dive into the decision-making process and sort of the lies we tell ourselves about our own ego and id and how we make decisions. Couldn't recommend it more. It's probably the best podcast I've ever listened to. In terms of books, the only one that comes to mind at the top of my head now is someone called Humility is the New Smart. Highly recommend it. It's basically, that's where I got the idea that we're never going to beat machines at recalling information, data storage or data recall. The author of the book, basically the argument is, you know, we need to adapt the way humans are valued in the workforce by realizing that creativity and insight is kind of our magic power. And as AI becomes a more integral part of every sector of the business and the government, we need to sort of change the reason we have humans in the workplace. And for intelligence community people, that is creativity and insight.
Okay, next question. This is kind of a long one, so let's see if you can be as brief as possible. Otherwise, we could probably spend 4 hours on this one alone. This is what are some of the characteristics of a future national security construct in terms of self-organization around tasks, incentive / reward systems, or other dimensions that might really change how we do our work?
So I'll keep it brief. I think you nailed it in the first couple words. It's organization around tasks. We need to have more of a model that is, as I've said before, more of like an organism where teams can come together organically, work on a task or a crisis or an issue, and then separate when that crisis subsides, and then carry that information back into the workforce as kind of like a lessons learned practice.
Okay, Joe's got the next one. What's the path to fixing the overclassification problem? This is another one we could talk about for 4 days.
That's a whole podcast by itself. I mean, that's a book. I think it's, I don't know what the solution is, but I know the problem is we inherited this from, like, again, the Cold War. And, you know, the imperative there was to keep information out of the Soviets' hands. I think I often use the example of an XY sort of axis, where if you consider the value of secrecy and the detriment of secrecy, we would have crossed kind of a point sometime, you know, maybe 10 or 20 years ago, where the detriment of having the security classification system is greater now than the benefits it gives us. I think we would be better off if information was more readily available to everyone in the network. I mean, obviously there's some stuff you have to keep secret, like, you know, weapons capabilities and stuff like that. We don't want our vulnerabilities to get out there. But, you know, a lot of the stuff the IC does is contextual information, and we make it way too hard for people to access it. So they're going to go to, you know, whatever their favorite news source is online and get it from there, because it's easier and it's cheaper. So that's the one thing I would do, is make information more widely available to everyone, not just in the executive branch, but in the legislative branch. You know, the American people, we need to supply information to them. And the IC kind of does this now. There's something called the public's daily brief, but it's not particularly well known or well advertised. We need a lot more of that, I think.
Okay, here's another question relating to key future technologies, primarily that quantum is probably the hardest one to understand, but potentially has the most important for US operations in the future. And so what do you think the role of the intelligence community should be as an early adopter?
Well, yeah, I mean, typically when we think of quantum, we think of encryption and decryption, and that's a huge, I mean, that is, you know, that's a huge threat to NSA and what they're, I guarantee you that NSA is working very hard right now trying to figure out how they're going to do quantum encryption and decryption. If, you know, if there's a state competitor that comes online with a real sort of no shit, excuse my French, quantum computer in the next few years that can break encryption, that's a game-changing threat for everything we do today. So we want to be on the leading edge of that. I left government as a contractor about a month ago. So I'm not read on the classified information anymore. So I don't, you know, I can't really speak to the status or anything of that. But I know that in terms of the IC, we care about encryption and sending messages and then decryption. And I don't know, I'm sure there's lots of smart people working on it, but I'm not an expert and can't speak to that.
And then the last question that we'll have before we do closing remarks and sort of sum up what we've had today is, how do we facilitate a virtuous shadow intelligence community, sort of like DEF, where we partially leverage those talent pools that have difficulty entering into the government?
Oh, that's a question after my own heart. One of my good friends and I have actually thought about how we would create sort of a parallel as a startup, because, you know, no one is going to give the IC the authority to just tear things down and start from scratch, because that would leave us incredibly vulnerable for however long, years, I'm certain. So, you know, the way that it's going to get done is there's going to be some sort of startup or pilot program that would say, hey, what if we did it this way? That's going to require funding, probably in the NDAA, to do some sort of pilot program. The challenge with that is, of course, that existing institutions, their motivation is going to be to underfund it or crush it or squat, you know, not give it the resources it needs. So really you need congressional champions or presidential champion that can kind of safeguard and shepherd any new effort for the extent of its life, so it can actually come together and prove the value or prove that it's not valuable, whatever the case may be. So that requires strong supporters. And I don't know who that is, but it's gonna require, you know, congressional or presidential action.
Okay, since we have just a couple minutes, are there any last comments that you would like to make as we're wrapping up?
No, I think this has been super fun. I mean, I could easily do this for another hour. So, you know, I really appreciate the opportunity to come talk to everybody.
Absolutely. So today we actually learned a lot. We want to thank Zach for spending time with us, and for all of you for spending time with us as well. One thing I'll let you know is that the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum is a free organization to join. It's DEF.org. So please come be a part of this virtuous insurgency that we have that's trying to break the way things are done across the national security space in a positive manner. If you like these types of events, they are going on all over the US virtually right now. So please check out our DEF website and you can see when they're happening. The next one that I will be hosting will be on Friday. And that one starts a little bit later in the evening. It starts at 6:30 p.m. And we are going to be talking about OKRs. So objectives and key results. And we're going to look at, how do we enable OKRs across a large bureaucracy, by looking at Nick Sutterberg and what he did with OKRs at Kessel Run, which is one of the Air Force's, or actually the Air Force's first software factory, and then created a new way of thinking for all of the services and how they develop and deploy and enable software development and mission problems and mission challenges. So with that, I would like to say thank you to everybody for coming. I hope you have a wonderful evening, and we hope to see you at the next DEF event.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. We love ideas and feedback, so feel free to send your thoughts to hello@def.org. For more great content and to stay in the loop about community events and activities, follow us on social media and subscribe to our monthly newsletter. Everyone plays a part in building the innovative national security culture we want to see. To find where you fit, just go to def.org/join. That's def.org/join.